All right, Erev Tov. Hope everybody's well. Okay. As we prepare to end Sefer Vayikra, I just want to again thank Yecheski and the Rubin who've been sponsoring the entire series in Sefer Vayikra, the Haftarah of Sefer Vayikra, in memory of Yecheski's father, Chaim ben Yechesko Shraga. She should have happy occasions to celebrate, and our learning should help both in this world and in the Olam HaEmet, in the upper worlds too. So let's learn together and join the two worlds here together. Dr. Sokolov, Akasha.
Okay, let me start with this. Okay, so this week, we have a double sidra, Bahar, which features the laws of Shemitah and Yovel, and Bechukotai, which features the Tochecha, rather lengthy and detailed and somewhat morbid, dire warning of impending doom and catastrophe if we stray from the straight and narrow. The Haftarah is joined more to the second Sidra, to Bechukotai. It mirrors the Tochecha, it mirrors the rebuke, the chastisement, but I don't want to leave the Sidra of Bahar entirely orphaned, so to speak, particularly since the next Jewish year, 5782, is scheduled to be a year of Shemitah. So I thought that I should say something about Shemitah. So I found something that I hope you'll find interesting. Most of what Shemitah is about nowadays is highly charged, either politically or religiously or philosophically. There were three Zionistically inclined rabbis in Eastern Europe at the close of the 19th century who wanted to support the efforts of the new Chalutzim, of those Jews who had begun at the end of the 19th century to make their way to the land of Israel and to engage, or in some cases, re-engage in agriculture. And therefore, these three Eastern European rabbis got together and they declared that it is permissible to sell land in Israel to non-Jews for the Shemitah year, so that the land technically is not under Jewish ownership, and therefore the farmers could continue to work it, since they were not working Jewish-owned land, but they were at least nominally working land that was owned by Gentiles. This has since come to be known in Hebrew as the Heter Mechira, that is to say, the sanction to continue working the land during Shemitah by virtue of its sale to non-Jews. That is pretty much the practice of the religious kibbutzim in Israel and of most, though not all, of the religious moshavim in Israel. And it is at least nominally the position of the chief rabbinate. There is, however, an opposing position, and that's the position that was taken initially at the end of the 19th century by the Eidah Haredit, by the, that's been all over the newspapers for the last week, so I suppose nobody really needs to be told what Haredim are. The Eidah Haredit was an organized group of Haredim that existed already in the 19th century, well before the establishment of the State of Israel. They opposed and continue to oppose the Heter Mechira, and therefore they will only eat produce that was actually grown by Arabs on Arab-owned land, or they're rather careful to make sure that they use only things that were grown during the year or years prior to Shemitah. I hate to tell you what the official position is of the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations of America, which you might suspect of being somewhat more modern and somewhat more moderately inclined than the Eidah Haredit. I suggest you Google Shemitah, OU, and you'll be disappointed as I was. Okay, having said that, and therefore having basically said that, I am not going to jump into the question, any of these questions. I thought nevertheless to share with you something rather entertaining apropos of Shemitah. And that comes to us courtesy of this. I don't know if you're acquainted with it. It's been featured on the website of Bar Ilan University, this feature for, I suppose, the better part of the last, 20, 25 years, maybe even more than that. It's a weekly study in the parasha, courtesy largely but not exclusively of faculty of Bar Ilan University. I say largely but not exclusively because it just happens to be by coincidence that I have a contribution to this, to the Bar Ilan Parsha website. It even happens to be apropos of this week's Sidra of Bechukotai. But this, as you see, at least if you can read the Hebrew, the title reads as follows, okay? Ha'amad ha'mechunan shal ha'mispar sheva, the lofty, as it were, status of the number seven, upela ha'gimatriot, and the wonder of gematria, alphanumerics, be'erkei sheva, with the values of seven. And basically what this author did is he sat there, I suppose either with a calculator or with an abacus or maybe just with his fingers. And he totaled up the value of the letters in the psukim in this week's Sidra that address the question of Shemitah. Let's just remind ourselves, and you see it shaded here at the top of the page, that this week's Sidra tells us that every seventh year, the land is supposed to lie fallow, and that's called Shemitah. And then after every seven cycles of Shemitah, there is a 50th year, which is the Jubilee year, Yovel. So the Pasuk says, V'safar talacha, that you should keep count of, Sheva Shabtot Shanim, seven cycles of Shemitah. In other words, Sheva Shanim Sheva Pa'amim, seven times 7 years. V'ayulacha, and the total will be, Sheva Shabtot HaShanim, Tesha V'Arba'im Shana, 49 years, seven cycles of Shemitah. And if you look at this, it's just mind-blowing, okay? Sheva Shabtot Shanim, Sheva Shanim, okay? These words, okay, add up to a multiple of seven, okay? Just give you an approximation, right? It's somewhere in the vicinity of 2,500, right? Somewhere in that vicinity. It is a multiple. It is, if you have a calculator handy, if you can do these things in your head, the total is 7 times 378. So that part of the pasuk that says Sheva Shabtot Shanim, seven Shemitah cycles, Sheva Shanim, each one being 7 years, okay, where the word seven, Sheva, appears twice. The word Shabbat, which itself is a concept of seven, appears once, okay. The numerical value of these letters is itself a multiple of seven, okay. Then the verse continues and it says, Vahayulacha. Now, this one we can do ourselves, they're not too complicated, right? Lamed is 30, Kaf is 20, so Lacha is 50, okay? Vav is 6, so there are two Vavs, that's 12, okay? Yud is 10, that's 22. He is 5, that's 27. 50 and 27 is 77. So the words Vahayu Lacha, the continuation of the verse, are also a multiple of 7, okay? Then it says, Yemei Sheva Shabtot. Yemei Sheva Shabtot is 1,540, which itself is a multiple of seven. It's 7 times 220. and then the word Hashanim, right? Lecha and Hashanim is essentially a multiple of seven. It's 65 times seven, okay? Then the word Shabtot Hashanim, continuing in the verse, okay, are, again, 770, right? Another multiple of seven. The word Va'arba'im, right? This we can do ourselves, is 329, which is a multiple of seven, okay? And then Sheva Shabtot Hashanim, Tesha Va'arba'im Shana, we have the word Shabbat, again, as we said, which is reflects the concept of seven. You have Tesha Va'arba'im 49, which is seven times seven, okay? And this is also a multiple of seven. It's whatever the total would be of seven times 423. So it's absolutely incredible. Now, I admit freely and candidly, there's a little bit of, it's a bit tendentious, okay? Sometimes he combines words that are adjacent. Sometimes he has to combine words that are in the same verse, but not directly adjacent to each other, okay? Kind of reminiscent of the Bible codes, if you think back to them, where they also tended, to look for those words and those letters that helped their cause, sometimes overlooking the ones that didn't, okay? But in any event, I think it's just remarkable that in a short verse, whose essence is multiples of seven, you get so many multiples of seven in it. And as you can see in the continuation, he does the same thing for other psukim that talk about the number seven. For example, the purity of the Omer that we find ourselves in right now, right? It says that from the second day of Pesach, from the day on which we bring the barley offering, the Omer, we have to count Shiv'a Shavuot Tispor Lach. Shiv'a, seven, Shavuot, weeks, each one a period of seven. Seven, seven. Not surprisingly, it's also a multiple of seven. Okay, so as I said, I simply wanted to recognize the Sidra of Bahar and the topic of Shemitah, which is featured in it, and I hope that somehow we have met our obligation through this exercise in Gematria. And with that, I'll take us to our usual study. Okay. So as I said, when I I don't know if he noticed, but when I emailed my sources to Rabbi Kelman earlier today, I put in the subject line, my own 1619 project. So this is a 1619 project only because, as you can see on the second line, the Haftarah begins in the 16th chapter of the book of Yirmiyahu in the 19th verse of the 16th chapter. So this is my own 1619 project only by coincidence of the way in which the verses in the book of Yirmiyahu have been enumerated. In any event, as I already said in the introduction, the Haftarah is the Haftarah more of Bechukotai than it is of Bahar, because in a sense it mirrors the Tochecha, the rebuke, that is to say the words of warning that Moshe issued to the Jewish people, warning them what would come of them and of their land if they fell afoul, primarily of the Torah's restrictions against idolatry. So that is the theme of this Haftarah. Now, I want to take a step back and just share with you for a moment some of my planning for these conversations that we are having and have been having for a while now about the Haftarot. Each week, we take note of the fact that there is some link between the Haftarah and the Sidra of the week. Now, what does that mean? That means primarily and most immediately that the rabbis, whoever they were, and whenever it took place, who assigned a portion of one of the books of Nevi'im to be read each week at the conclusion of that week's Torah reading, that those rabbis saw that the books of Nevi'im, the books of the prophets, bore a distinct and tangible relationship to the Torah. But if you take a step further back, right, what it also says is that it reflects the fact that those prophets saw a connection between themselves and the Torah. And it is the connection that the prophets felt between themselves and the Torah that enabled them to address their contemporaries with words that at one and the same time were addressed to a specific audience about a contemporary issue, and yet at the same time were reminiscent of, let's call them, the more timeless values that were addressed by Moses to the Jewish people, right, hundreds of years earlier. So when I read a selection from the Nevi'im, one of the things that I'm always looking for or always listening for are echoes of the Torah. Where are words and phrases and ideas in the books of the Nevi'im, in the books of the prophet, their attempts to vivify, revive, certainly give contemporary meaning to the age-old, timeless wisdom of the Torah. So what I want to share with you this evening, the balance of this evening, is essentially a bunch of associations. As I read each pasuk of the Haftarah, I sat back and said to myself, does this remind you of anything? So some of the associations, as I said, are words. Some of the associations are more than individual words, they're whole phrases. And sometimes it isn't the specific words or the phrases, but it's the concept or the idea that is expressed. So here we go. Okay. It starts off, interestingly, the same way that the Tochecha ends. That is, on a positive note. The Torah doesn't want to leave us just simply shattered, as it were, by the by anxiety, driven by our fear over what might happen. The Torah wants to tell us that even if worse comes to worse, there is still a saving grace. The saving grace may be the minority of the Jewish people that remain steadfast in their observance of the Torah and whose observance somehow compensates even for the sins of the majority. The saving grace might be the merit of our ancestors, of which God is always conscious and always takes into account when dealing with us. Therefore, the Haftarah too starts off on a positive note, because it knows, the Navi knew, that he was going to express sharp words of rebuke and of criticism. He wanted to make sure that, again, that the people wouldn't just simply be shattered by it. So he starts off by telling them, Hashem uzi uma'uzi, God, my strength, my fortress, minusi biyom tzara, he provides me with refuge on a day in which I am in distress. Elecha, to God, who up until this point in time has been only the God of the Jewish people, Elecha goyim yavol me'afse aretz, even Gentiles will come to worship God, and they will come from the furthest ends of the earth, v'yomru, and what will they admit, what will they acknowledge? Ach sheker nachalu avotenu, that what we have inherited, the religions, or the lack of religion, the idolatrous practices that we have inherited from our ancestors are sheker. They are all false. They are all delusions. Hevel, they are all vain, futile. Ein bam mo'il, they are practically worthless. And they say, Hayaselo Adam Elohim, can man actually make a god? Vehema lo Elohim. Whatever it is that our idol factories have been churning out for all of these centuries or millennia, are not truly divine. And here you may remember that not too long ago in the Sidrav Shmini, when we're talking about what was the sin of the two sons of Aharon who met their deaths on the day of the initiation of the Mishkan, we read the pasuk, and you see it highlighted here in red, Vayakrivu lefnei Hashem, that they brought before God, Esh Zara, some sort of strange alien fire, flame, Asher lo tzivaotam, about which they were not instructed. And you remember that we looked at a number of different midrashim and commentaries as to what, to be precise, what was their sin. And one point of view said the sin was not what they did, but that whatever they did was without consultation, right? That they didn't consult with Moses or with Aaron, that they took initiative, okay? So that would be Nashalot Tzivaotam, about which they were not instructed, meaning, again, they did it on their own recognizance. But we said that there's another interpretation, and that is that they did something that they had actually been warned not to do, in which case the words Asher Lo Tzivaotam should be read Asher Tzivaotam Lo, about which they were instructed, no, meaning this is not to be done. So bearing that in mind, look again at the other verse that I cited here. In talking later on in the book of Devarim about a Jew who has gone astray and worships idols, it describes him as going and worshiping other deities and bowing to them, such as the sun, Hashemesh, the moon, Layareach, or l'chol tzva hashamayim, or to any heavenly body, asher lo tziviti. Does asher lo tziviti mean that he worshipped a heavenly body whom he was not instructed to worship? No, because there are no heavenly bodies that may be worshipped. Therefore, here too, it's likely that it should be read asher lo tziviti as though it said asher tziviti lo, about which you were instructed, no, meaning these are not to be worshipped. Taking that back here to the verse in Yirmiyahu, Hayaselo Adam Elohim, can man manufacture a deity? The Hema, whatever it is that our ancestors manufactured, lo Elohim, meaning the Hema Elohim, lo. Are these deities? No, no way. Okay. Lachem, in anticipation of all of this, right, says God, Hinini modiyam bapam hazod, I will teach them once and for all. Odi'em et yadi, I will make them aware of my strength, gvurati, my power, v'yadu'u, and they will all, that is to say, all the nations of the world will come to know kishmi Hashem, they will come to recognize me. Now he goes back to the words of rebuke, and he says, the sins of the people of Judah, Chatat Yehuda, Ketuvah, it's written. It's like out there in public. So much so, how is it written? Be'et Barzel, it's as though it were written with an iron pen, an iron stylus. Bitziporen Shamir, engraved as it were with the fingernail of a shamir. Okay? And where was it engraved? Aluach libam. It's as though it were engraved on the tablets of their hearts, which means it's something that they should have internalized. Ulekarnot mizbechotechem, and on the horns of their altars. That is to say, this is something that is both a matter of public knowledge, as well as something that has already been assimilated or ought to have been assimilated privately, individually. And this Tziporen Shamir also resonated with me, because the Shamir is one of the things that are described in the Mishnah in Avot. I don't know, Rabbi Kelman, are you past Perek already? Rabbi Kalman does
I'm not. We're in Perek Dalet. We're at the beginning of Perek Dalet.
So Perek Hey has several Mishnayot that all have a feature in common, which is they talk about 10 things. 10 things here, 10 things there, 10 things the other place. So one of the series of 10 things are 10 things that were created on Erev Shabbat, that is to say, on the original Friday afternoon, right? Bein Hashmashot at twilight. That is to say, the very first time that the world transitioned from Chol to Kodesh. And they were, and we're only interested in the ones that I've highlighted, Hashamir, okay? That doesn't help us because even in English, it's just translated as the Shamir. But notice the rest of the words there and match them up to the words in the verse in Yirmiyahu. Okay? Haketav, right? We have ketuvah in the Pasuk. Hamichtav, right? That's also a form of katav. Haluchot, right? Notice we have aluach libam. For some reason, I failed to highlight it, but I will make up for that now. Okay? So all of these items, the Shamir, the Ketav, the Michtav, the Luchot, all have something to do with inscriptions. Okay? What inscriptions? So the answer is, I should pause for a moment and say that some of you are probably already saying to yourself, oh, I know all about the Shamir. I know about the legend about King Solomon was building the temple. And in the temple, you're not allowed to use stones that are dressed with metal implements. And therefore, he knew that there was this worm called the Shamir that had the power and ability far beyond those of mortal men to dress stones. And therefore, he was anxious to obtain it. So he had to make a deal with the devil. Well, not so much with the devil, but at least with Ashmedai, right? The king of the spirit world, right? And then in return for whatever Solomon arranged with Ashmedai, Ashmedai brought him the Shamir, and he used the Shamir, okay? Well, that has nothing to do with this verse. Because this verse doesn't talk about engraving, doesn't talk about carving or dressing stones. It talks about carving or dressing tablets. And that's because the Shamir plays another role in a different Talmudic legend, the Shamir, the same Shamir, was used by Moses in order to inscribe the names of the tribes of Israel on the precious stones that represented them in the high priest's breastplate. That is to say, the names that were engraved on the stones of the Choshen that was worn by the Kohen Gadol, the inscriptions were made by the Shamir. Still doesn't tell you what a Shamir is. It's only the legend that tells you that it was a worm. But the other possibility is, look at the way it's translated in the verse. It's translated as an adamant point. That is to say, something that is particularly sharp. And therefore, the alternative identification of the Shamir is not something from the animal world, not something that comes out of the world of zoology, but rather something that comes out of the world of geology, that it's in itself a stone, but a particular stone whose quality, specific quality is that you can use it in order to chisel out or in order to dress other stones. Okay. And here, for those of you who want, is the entry on the Shamir in the old Jewish encyclopedia. I don't think anything new has been discovered about the Shamir in the century or so since this encyclopedia was published. So I don't think it's really necessary to find an entry in the newer Encyclopedia Judaica. As I said, I don't think there's anything to add to it. Okay. Then Yirmiyahu goes on, and he says, about the people, Kizkor b'nehem mizbechotam, when the children, the descendants of these people, will remember or recall their mizbechot, their altars, va'asherehem, their sacred trees, al etz ra'anan al givaot ha-givohot, because where did the idolatrous people in the land of Israel practice their idol worship? Their tendency was to seek high ground, right? The belief that God resides above in heaven is one that we still testify to. If you just think for a moment about all of our prayers that begin with Avinu Shabashamayim, our Father in heaven, even though we know, right, in the words of the famous 20th century Jewish philosopher Uncle Moshe, Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere, up, up, down, down, right, left, all around, here, there, everywhere, that's where Hashem is found. It just happens to be what the Talmud calls Lashon B'nei Adam, conventional speech, to speak of God as though somehow God resided in heaven as opposed to residing elsewhere. And therefore, high places, whether they were natural high places like mountains and hills, or whether they were artificial high places, were the ground that people ordinarily sought for their worship of idols. If you're trying to think of what is an example of an artificial high place, well, there are two that we know of from the Bible. One is an ordinary artificial high place. That's called a bama. Okay? You may remember that during the First Temple period, primarily during in the Northern Kingdom of Israel, specifically in the sites of Dan in the north and Beersheba in the south, right? The kings of Israel maintained golden calves. And throughout the land of Israel, they encouraged people, rather than going to Jerusalem and offering their sacrifices at the temple, that they should bring their sacrifices to the Bamot. Bamot just means a high place. And again, it's an artificial high place. The more famous or infamous high place, of course, is the Tower of Babel, right? Vayhi chol ha'aretz, Genesis 11, safa achat u'dvarim achadim. Right? They built a tower. They said, hava nivnem migdal, ir u'migdal v'rosho b'shamayim. Let's build a tower with its head in the heavens. And the rabbis understood intuitively that they were trying to do is overthrow God. Because the idea behind the Migdal Bavel, which and the greatest likelihood was what historians call a ziggurat, right? Essentially a terraced pyramid, such as the kind that we're more familiar with from Central and South America, rather than the sloped pyramids of Egypt, was built in order to facilitate access to God. Okay, so this idea too of worshiping idols on were represented either Eitz Ra'anan, flourishing trees, or to worship them upon Givahot HaGivohot, upon lofty hills, was also reminiscent of this week's Torah reading, where God warns the Jewish people that, again, the consequence of their going astray is Vishmadati et Bamotechem, I will destroy your high places, and I will eliminate all of the objects of your idol worship, etc. And it is even more nearly identical in a later verse in the book of Devarim, where an instruction is given to the Jewish people that upon their entry into the land of Israel, Abeta Abdun, they should destroy utterly et kol hamekomot, all of the places asher avedu sham hagoyim, in which the nations of Canaan worshipped their idols. And it says specifically, al heharim haramim, on the lofty mountains, v'al hagevahot, and on the hilltops, v'tachat kol etz ra'anam, and beneath all of the flourishing trees. So here too, we can see how the Navi was inspired, both in the concept as well as in its formulation by the Torah. Then, he says, he addresses someone whom he calls Harari Basadeh. Now remember, you just said something about Givaot, about hills. So he says, Harari Basadeh, a mountain or a mound in the field. Chelacha. Chayil could mean strength. Chayil could mean an army. Chayil could mean a wall. Kol otzrotecha lavazeteng. God says that all of the treasures of this, of whatever this signifies, will be given as spoils. Okay, bamotecha, the high places, bechatat bechol gvulecha, will be like again a spoil throughout the borders of the land of Israel. So again, you can see this is the overturning of the practices of idol worship. And now comes what to my mind is the key verse in linking the Haftarah to the Sidrah, because it starts off with the word Vishamatata, clearly a deliberate attempt to play on the word Shemitah. Vishamatata, right? You will give up, you will relinquish, you will forfeit. Uvacha minachalatecha, by your own actions, right? What will you forfeit? Your nachala, your inheritance, asher natati lecha, which God gave to the Jewish people. Vahavadticha et oyevecha, and God will make the Jewish people into slaves of their enemies. Ba'aretz asher lo yadata, not even in their own land, but in a land that they've never been to before. Why? Ki esh kedachtem ba'api, because you have kindled my anger. Anger is always compared to a flame or to a fire. Ad olam tukad, and to be such a flame or such a fire that it will burn forever. And that, of course, is a reflection of yet another verse in this week's Torah reading, again, part of the Tochecha, which says that if it reaches the point where the Jewish people will not observe the Shemitah, and therefore God will punish them and will either chase them out of the land or will turn it over to their enemies, it says, as, then, right? Meaning when it's already too late to do anything about it, tirtze ha'aretz et shabtoteha. Then the land, so to speak, will be able to make up for all of the Shemitah years that it was not observed, right? Kol yemei hashama, it will be barren, desolate, right? Va'atem be'eretz oyvechem, while you remain exiled in the lands of your enemies. Az, then, tishbata aretz, because there'll be nobody there, right? Then the earth, the land, will be able to take its respite, vihirtzat et shabtoteha, and it will, as it were, compensate or make up for all of those lost shmitot. Kol yemei hashama tishbot, it will remain desolate throughout this time, et asher lo shavita, in the consequence of the fact that it wasn't given the opportunity to rest, bishabtotechem, in the established periods of rest time, the Shemitah years, b'shiftechem aleha, when the land was occupied by the Jewish people. Now, Shemitah, one of the things that Shemitah accomplishes is that it gives the people an opportunity to make manifest their trust in God. Because the Torah says so. Torah says, at some point you're going to ask yourself, right? can't work the seventh year. At the end of seven cycles of Shemitah, that is to say the 49th year, right? It's a Shemitah year, I don't work. The 50th year is a Jubilee year, Yovel. The laws of Yovel are the same as Shemitah, you may not work the land. Therefore, the land is going to remain fallow for the 49th year and the 50th year. Then will come the first year of the next cycle of 50 years. But because it's the beginning, because nothing was planted, because no agricultural work was done for the two previous years, nothing's going to grow in the 51st year until, you know, pretty much late in, if not the tail end of the 51st year. So at some point, the people are going to sit back and say to themselves, whoa, how are we going to survive if for three consecutive years, we're not going to be able to grow anything to eat? So the Torah says the answer is they have to trust. You have to trust that, first of all, that God will provide such abundant harvest in the 46th, 47th, 48th years, that first of all, you'll be able to stock up on things. Okay? And bear in mind, while it's prohibited during the Shemitah year to cultivate the ground, it's not prohibited to allow things to grow. You don't walk around and say, oh, look, something's growing during Shemitah, and pull it out of the ground. It can't be cultivated, right? You can't plow, you can't sow, you can't irrigate, right? You can't harvest. But if things grow on their own, right, they're accessible. Therefore, in essence, the Shemitah year is a proving ground, is an agricultural proving ground for the faith in God. And that may well be why the prophet Yirmiyahu now turns to the moral of the story. And in the next series of psukim that you see on the screen now, he balances the negative and the positive. And of course, I highlighted the negative in red and the positive in green. So he says as follows, Ko amar Hashem, thus saith the Lord, Arur, cursed, hagever, be the man, asher yuvtach ba'adam, who places his trust only in himself or in his fellow man, v'sam basar zro'o, who makes human effort his strength, while min Hashem yasur libo, while turning his thoughts away from God. That's bad. Therefore, what is the fate of such a person? V'haya ke'arar ba'arava, he will be like a bush in the desert. Lo yireh ki avoto, he's not going to see any goodness, right? Everything was just going to be desolate, arid, and dry. Vishachan charirim bamidbar, right? He dwells in the scorched places of the desert. Eretz melecha, land that could just as well have been sown with salt for all that it produces, for the little that it produces. V'lo teshev, and is generally uninhabited. I'm going to skip the little print for a moment just to come to the positive side. On the other hand, Baruch HaGever, blessed is the man, Asher Yivtach Bashem, who places his trust in God, Vaya Hashem Yivtacho, and whose trust is in God alone. Okay? And what will be his faith? Vahaya, he will be like Ke'etz Shatul Al Mayim, like a tree that has been planted near a water, va'al yuval yishalach shorashav, so that its roots can reach out into a stream of water, v'lo yireh ki avochom, unlike the bush in the desert that is perpetually arid and desolate, this tree will never see dryness, will never see heat, as it were. Vahaya alehu ra'anan, its leaves will be fresh. Uvishnat batzoret lo yidag, he won't worry even in a year of famine. V'lo yamish me'asot peri, and it never ceases to yield fruit. The contrast between the bush in the desert, the sign, the epitome of aridness and desolation, as opposed to the tree whose roots go into the stream and whose fruit is perennial, right? That's a comparison, a contrast that we see very often in the book of Tehillim. And you see some of the instances here. On the negative side of the ledger, right? Here we have, right? Hinei hagever lo yasim Elohim ha'uzo. A man, again, who does not place his trust in God, v'yiftach berov oshro, and instead places his trust in only his wealth, that is to say, in his own means, ya'oz b'havato, it's as though his existence will be pointless. Okay. On the other hand, what do we say about righteous people? In the very first chapter of the book of Psalms, the righteous is compared to Eitz Shatul al Palgei Mayim, again to the tree that's planted where there is abundant water. Or the psalmist again says of himself, Va'ani kezayit ra'anan, right? The righteous are like fruitful olive trees. Or, as we say in the Mizmor Shir, Liyom HaShabbat, Tzadik, the righteous, katamar yifrach, flourish like date palms. Ke'erez bavanon yiske, they can grow as tall as the cedars of Lebanon. Because shitulim, again, see all of the common words, right? Because they are shitulim, they are planted, b'veit Hashem, in the house of the Lord, b'chatzrot Eloheinu, in his precincts, yafrichu, flourishing, bearing fruit, od yinuvun b'seva, and again. So this too, as I said, was reminiscent, an attempt, by the way. There have been scholars who have suggested that one of, in fact, maybe even the principal author of the book of Tehillim was not necessarily King David, even though many of the chapters in the book of Tehillim bear his name. They argue that those aren't signs of his authorship, but rather they are honorifics. They were written in his honor because he was the original psalmist, but they maintain that one of the other contributors to the book of Tehillim was Yirmiyahu HaNavi, and they cite parallels like this in support of their arguments. And we draw near to the close. Ani Hashem choker lev, God says of himself that he can examine people's hearts. God's not a cardiologist. Choker lev means to investigate people's thoughts. I believe we've made this point in the past, that the idea that thoughts emanate from the brain was not something that they knew in the ancient world. If you asked an ancient where thoughts originate, they would have identified thoughts with the heart. Lev chacham limino, lev ksil lismolo, because they knew that the heart was the most important organ in the body, and therefore they assumed that thoughts emanated from the heart. I don't know exactly when the brain was discovered, but it was well after the biblical period. Okay. And this too, as I demonstrate, has its parallels elsewhere in the book of Yirmiyahu, where again, God is described as one who is able, as it were, to examine people's thoughts. Kore dagar velo yalad, osher, ose osher velo v'mishpat. Ose osher, somebody who acquires wealth, v'lo b'mishpat, through unjust means. The verse says, b'chatzi amav ya'azvenu, he'll lose that fortune. Uva'achrito, and ultimately, yihiyeh naval, he'll be proven a fool. I don't know that that's necessarily historically true, but there's certainly enough people still languishing in mostly federal prisons, precisely because they acquired their riches unjustly. They were caught for it. And in retrospect, I don't know whether they admit to themselves that they were foolish, but certainly the people whom they bilked will say that. Kisei kavod marom merishon mekom mikdashenu. Some words in praise of the temple of the Beit HaMikdash, which is compared to God's throne. And then Mikvei Yisrael Hashem. You know, Hatikva, the hope. So Mikvei Yisrael, the hope of Israel. God is the hope of Israel. Therefore, Kol Ozevecha, all those who would leave, abandon, forsake him, Yevoshu, will be put to shame. Okay. Visurai ba'aretz yikatevu, right? Those who turn away from God will be doomed. Ki azavu mekor mayim chayim et Hashem, because they abandoned God, who is truly the source of all life. See, we thought when we started that the word mikveh was simply like the word hatikva, meaning hope. God is the hope of Israel. But when we get to the end of the Pasuk, and we see that God is also compared to Makor Mayim Chayim, to a well or a source of living waters, we stop and we say, wait a second. The Hebrew word for that is a mikvah or mikveh mayim. So what we have here is a double entendre, or if you wish, maybe even a pun. When we refer to God as Mikveh Yisrael, right? It means, yes, of course, the people of Israel are supposed to put their trust in God. That was the whole lesson of Baruch HaGever Asher Yiftach Bashem. Blessed is the man who places his trust in God. So, of course, Mikveh Yisrael Hashem, the Jewish people are supposed to place its trust in God. But we also have to admit and to acknowledge the play on words here, that God is also somehow the Mikveh in the sense that God provides the Jewish people with a source of purification. And indeed, those are the words that are attributed to Rabbi Akiva. Those are words that we often say during the Aseret Yemei Teshuvah. There are people who recite it religiously if during that period of time they go to a mikvah. Rabbi Akiva said, Ashreichem Yisrael, how good is it for the Jewish people, right? Lifnei mi atem mitaharim, before whom can you purify yourselves? Umi mitaher etchem, and who can provide you with the means of purification? And he quotes the verse, Mikveh Yisrael Hashem. God is not only the hope of the Jewish people, God is also in that sense the mikvah, that is to say, the means through which the Jewish people is able to purify itself. And the concluding pasuk in this week's Haftarah is also one that resounds with us on an almost daily basis. The Navi, giving expression to the hopes of the Jewish people, addresses God and says, Refa'eni Hashem, if you, God, will offer me, will write for me the right prescription, a rafe, then I am sure that I'm going to be healed. Hoshi'eni, if you offer me salvation, Ivashea, I will be saved, Kitihilati ata, because you are the one who is deserving of my praise and of my glorification. And that, of course, as you can see, is something that was transformed into one of the brachot of the Amidah. And almost day in and day out, with the exception of Shabbatot and Yamim Tovim, we recite the bracha of Refuah, quoting this pasuk in the book of Yirmiyahu, Rafa'enu in the plural, because all of our prayers nearly all of our prayer, certainly all of the entirety of the Amidah, is expressed in the grammatical plural, right? Rafa'enu Hashem v'nei rafe, hoshi'enu v'nivashe'a, ki tehilatenu ata. And with that, we conclude. Let's see what we have here. Okay. Oh, the 1619 reference. For most of my life, I lived in Borough Park on 54th Street between 16th and 17th Avenues. And my address was Scouts Honor, 1619 54th Street. So that's all you really need to know. The fact that there is it's been around for a while, but has received a lot of publicity, especially in the last year, a project to remind Americans about the vicissitudes and evils of African American slavery is purely coincidence. Okay, I think that's pretty much it.
Correct. Yes, yes. Okay, thank you. Okay, so next week, Bamidbar, Erev Shavuos. That's always we read Bamidbar before Shavuot. I think from Hoshea, if I'm not mistaken, the Haftorah is next week, if I remember from last year. But anyways, okay, thank you. Tomorrow morning, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, Shuli Mishkan continuing her series on the modern state of Israel. And that followed tomorrow evening by Rabbi Shaul Robinson of Lincoln Square Synagogue, our weekly Parshat HaShavuos here, followed Friday morning by yours truly, my Pirkei Avot here at 9:30 a.m. And then Sunday, Rabbi Feldman will be back this week, Halach and Human Relations and Rabbi Liebtag, et cetera, et cetera. We have a full schedule of all our, you know, please God, 12 classes next week. So we look forward to learning with you. Everybody should be well and invite a friend. And thank you very much. There is one question just came in. Was there a time they did not observe, you know, Shemitah? Yes, you can.
Yes, yeah. All the way from the destruction of the Second Temple until 1889. As far as I know, there is no historical evidence for the observance of Shemitah from the time of the destruction of the temple until it was renewed, as I was said in the beginning, in 1889. That's part of the reason why those rabbis who promulgated the Heter Mechira, the sanction for the sale of the land, were able to do so, because there is no evidence that Shemitah Bisman Hazeh, that the observance of Shemitah in the absence of a temple is a requirement. It's not mandatory.
Are you claiming that in the Second Temple period it wasn't observed either?
No, I said from the time of the destruction of the Second Temple
by Cheney,
until,
right?
Until 1889, there's no historical evidence, meaning there were Jews living in the land of Israel. And for all we know, it's maybe they counted, maybe, you know, in the years in between, maybe in the early years after the destruction of the temple, maybe they kept the Shemitah. We just have no evidence of it.
In Tzfat, didn't they, in Tzfat, the Beit Yosef and that whole time period, they didn't keep Shemitah? Okay, interesting. And I thought the first Shemitah was 1882, but maybe I'm wrong, 1881, 82. I think that's when they...
I know that the first time that the Heter Mechira was published in 1888, in anticipation of 1889. So it could be, I don't remember offhand, you could be, it's 7 years, it would make sense.
No, of course, of course. I just have in my mind that the first time it came up as a real question was 1881,
82. No, no, no. See, 1881, 1882 is the Aliyah of the Biluyim. So it's possible, to my mind, not likely that so soon after their arrival, they would have already gotten concerned about Shemitah. I really don't know.
Yeah, I'll look in Reverend Munn's book. Okay, we'll take a look. Thank you. Of course, they say they wasn't so widely observed in the Beit Rishon either. That was part of the punishment of the Jewish people. You know, that's in the Tochach itself says that, as you're mentioning, you know, we punished for not keeping Shemitah. But anyways, please, you know, we could have soon. I think we mentioned it. I don't know, was it in this class recently? Once the majority of the Jewish people are living in the land of Israel, theoretically, that opens up a whole new halachic issues, and it's happening very soon. The majority of Jewish people are living in the land of Israel, and then we can have Yovel in theory. I mean, I don't want to get the technical problems, of course.
Well, you know,
the Shvatim, I know, I'm aware, but still, it's a concept that Yovel applies when the majority of the Jewish people are living in Israel, and then Shemitah becomes a biblical command, et cetera, et cetera.
That may be the saving grace of all the attempts to identify Myanmar and all places like that as being the 10 lost tribes. It may be the saving grace, because as long as the more dubious Jews that can be identified outside the land of Israel, then the longer it'll take for the majority of the Jewish people to be inside the land of Israel.
But I would assume we would want the majority of Jewish people living in Israel. That's a good
positive. Well, that's going to complicate. Listen, they can't elect a government. They can't elect
a
government.
We're not talking politics.
You think they're going to agree on a mashiach and a beis hamikdash?
Okay. We're not going there. The only thing that heartens me, and believe me, we talk about it a lot here, it's sad story often, but is, you know, when we compare our government in Israel, as much as you don't like, people may not like the religious thing, can't get a government together, we're way better than the kings of Tanakh. The fact that, you know, the state of Israel is the greatest supporter of Torah education ever in the history of the world. You know, the secular state, the Zionists, you know, whatever you want to call them, and all the people who complain. So compared to, you open up the Tanakh and you see what the kings were like, Oved Avodah Zarah and this and terrible. So Baruch Hashem, I think we're much better. Our leaders are much better. So that's a little bit of a comforting thought. Yes, I have a lot to say about the politics in Israel, but of course, living in Toronto, I only say these things mainly only privately. So, you know, anyways, but we'll see. Yes, it would be nice if they could get a functioning government. We'll see if Lapid can put it together, Lapid and Bennett. I'll talk not so much politically. I think it would be a beautiful thing. And we need a national unity government. And Netanyahu was machshir the Arabs. I know I'm breaking my promise in a little bit, but Netanyahu basically laid the groundwork to bring Arabs into the coalition or outside of whatever you want to call it. We need unity. I don't think that's a bad thing necessarily. I think it could be a very positive thing, hopefully. And I think it would be wonderful if Labor and Meretz and New Hope and sits in one government and can get peace and show we can get along, you know, that would be wonderful. That would be the King coming of Mashiach. No Sinat Chinam. Okay, nobody has to agree with me or listen with me, but it's after the class, so now I can talk, you know, we can say what we like. But anyways, but it would be wonderful. Listen, that the mature, who would have believed 70 years ago that we're near a place, you know, in 1945, who could have believed this? It's really, the miracles are unbelievable. Yom Yerushalayim, of course, is on Monday. So I think we should be cognizant. We're often complain a lot, but we're very blessed and wonderful things. And okay, enough of me. Anybody else is happy to put in their comments, disagree with me, say what you'd like. But otherwise, Lila Tov to everybody, and Doctor will see.
Yeshkayach and see the positive.
I'm sorry.
Yeshkayach and see the positive.
Yeah, if you see the positive. Listen, there's lots of negative to see, but we try to work on the positive. Listen, whatever, we do what you can, and listen, yeah. All right, Jewish people are amazing. The fact that we're here, you know, 4,000 years later. I always say, where the proof? I tell my kids, someone's talking to me privately, like I teach in chat, I tell my students, we're proof of Darwin, survival of the fittest. We're 12 million Jews after, you know, there are 1.8 billion Christians and 1.5 billion Muslims. We've been around, you know, twice or three times as long. There are only 12 million of us. So yes, there was persecution and Holocaust, but the Christians and the Muslims were killing each other too. And most Jews didn't have what it took to remain Jews. Most Jews throughout history have assimilated. And those who haven't assimilated, and I include, you know, anybody who identifies as a Jew, regardless of their religious thing, you know, that's a wonderful thing, a wonderful testament. So we should be very happy about that. Okay, I think I spoke enough. But,
good night.
Anyways, have a good night. Bye-bye.
Good night. Thank you.
Good night. Good night. Thank you.